Cause number 13-19-500-CV, Texas Auto Salvage, Inc. et al. Versus D.D. Ramirez, Inc. et al.
So this appeal, as the court noted, is about the granting of a JNOV. And that JNOV nullified and set aside a jury verdict. As a result of that JNOV, the trial court refused to even consider and therefore denied Tazzy's request for injunctive relief that would have, we intended, for it to resolve the misconduct that the jury had found in the operative jury question. As a result of that ruling, the trial court essentially entered a take-nothing judgment against Tazzy, and we believe that that is error. Now, on appeal, Mr. Ramirez, who, by the way, operates right across the street from Tazzy, and he operates an auto salvage business, exactly like we do, right across the street from Tazzy. Mr. Ramirez has offered four different arguments to support or an attempt to support what the trial court did. First of all, they basically said, as a matter of law, we're not entitled to injunctive relief, period, no matter what. Second, they say that we didn't have evidence of standing. Third, they say that we did not obtain a liability finding in the operative jury question. And then finally, they say somehow that all we sought was a declaratory judgment action, and that's inappropriate. So I'd like to take each one of those as time allows or whatever the court is interested in hearing about. But I'll start with that very first one, which is a legal argument. Basically, they say that no one, no private citizen has any right to seek injunctive relief when another private party has violated an ordinance. And they call that do-it-yourself enforcement of the ordinance. And the law is not on their side here. Going all the way back to 1911, and even relying on one of the cases they cite, which is Schmitz versus Denton Cowboy Church. I'm just going to call it the Cowboy Church case. Every one of those cases all stand for the same proposition. And that is, if that private citizen has standing, if that private citizen has some direct stake, then that private citizen has the ability to seek injunctive relief to stop someone from violating an ordinance. There are some exceptions. There are some, for example, they cite a case called Savoring. And they say Savoring stands for the proposition that you can't enforce a zoning ordinance. The difference in that case is that the authorizing statute from the legislature creating this floodplain statute that allowed the city to create a zoning ordinance specifically for floodplaining expressly provides that only the city would be able to enforce it. Otherwise, we have to look at Texas Supreme Court cases that have endorsed the use of injunctive relief to require a private citizen to follow an ordinance. I feel like American Construction versus Selig is a very good example because it's very similar. What happened in that case is the city of Austin was allowing an individual that it was a construction company, who knows why, but they were allowing that construction company to take up more of the street. In other words, to create more of a blockage of the street. Interestingly, it was on Congress Avenue and it was right next to the Driscoll. And the city actually created not an ordinance, but they had a resolution that said, hey, it's okay for you to do this. Well, the private citizens filed suit against that construction company and a district court entered an injunction that required that construction company to comply with the city ordinance. And that was affirmed by the Texas Supreme Court. We go all the way from the down the road timeline to the Cowboy Church case. And in Cowboy Church, there were a number of plaintiffs. There was a group of plaintiffs. In that case, there were essentially the prime plaintiff, which was Mr. Schmitz. And then there were groups of other plaintiffs. These groups of other plaintiffs, unlike Mr. Schmitz, were unable to show that they had any direct stake. They were supposed to present some proof that there was, their allegation was that there was a diminution in the value of their property. But they
doesn't that case say that the he was not, that they, none of the appellants were permitted to seek injunctive and declaratory relief. Only that one plaintiff had standing to seek redress for a nuisance violation.
However, that is true. He could seek redress for nuisance, but the issue had not yet. I don't believe that court says that Mr. Schmitz did not have any ability to seek injunctive relief. In fact, I think later in the case, they talk about how a zoning ordinance can be enforced by injunctive relief. So I think the language is there that supports a finding. And I think it's just really important to look at the similarities in that Mr. Schmitz was just 50 feet from the back of the Cowboy Church, and he had lights that were coming in. So there was some concern that there was going to be a violation of the ordinance. Maybe the ordinance had not been violated yet. In our case, that is a distinctive difference. Here, we have a jury finding that Mr. Ramirez and his operations had violated Chapter 16 more than 100 times. And here's another really important difference, Chief, and that is Chapter 16 incorporates the standard of care for the auto salvage industry. And that is an extremely important differentiation from the Cowboy Church case. Chapter 16, and this is undisputed evidence in the case, is that several, including Tazzy, were involved with the city because the city did not feel like it had sufficient rules to cause this, what could be a very dangerous business, to act and perform and operate in a safe and peaceful way. All that was out there at that point was the standard of care. So what they did was the city, with the help of some of the industry leaders, including Tazzy, developed Chapter 16, which incorporated the standard of care. So when you violate Chapter 16, you do two things, which is very different from Schmitz and Cowboy Church. When you violate Chapter 16, you violate the standard of care. And number two, you also violate Chapter 16. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why, in addition to Selig, Boone, Ort, and a number of other cases where I think we gave you some supplemental authorities of different examples of the courts recognizing the viability of obtaining injunctive relief when an individual violates an ordinance.
Except that Chapter 16 and the language upon which you're relying, where it does say that this type of conduct could constitute a public nuisance. I'm trying to find where I highlighted it. Yeah, 16.210.7.
Yes.
Says conditions maintained in violation of this division are deemed a public nuisance. But then the very final paragraph of the entire ordinance, the only remedy it provides is a fine, a fine, class C misdemeanor offense, or upon conviction, fine, that's it. It doesn't provide for anything else.
I don't disagree with you. I think the city is bound by the terms of its ordinance in the kind of relief it can seek. However, when a private individual files suit and that provision incorporates a standard of care, and that is a given in this case, then requiring or creating an injunction that requires Mr. Ramirez and his operations to comply with the standard of care, which will be complying with Chapter 16, I think that is... the case law in Texas says you absolutely can do that. And here's a really...
Let's talk about your injuries, though, before you run out of time, because I think that's critical here, since you've argued that the basis for the trial judge awarding this JNOV was because he said it had to be substantial. And so I have a question about what the proper standard is.
Yes. And I think you've hit exactly on it. Let me say one more thing real quickly about sure. that last point. And that is that the chapter 16, what's really important here is that we never even got the chance to have an injunction, to even look at what the terms of the injunction were. I don't disagree with you, Judge, that if we had sought like a criminal fine or our injunction gave us the kind of relief that only the city could get, we would not be allowed to have that injunction. But if our injunction enforces the standard of care as adopted into Chapter 16, that would be entirely appropriate. So let me move on to the next issue. There is more than some evidence of standing, as standing is properly defined by the state of Texas following federal law. Standing means having skin in the game. The language that you see in our case law is a violation of a personal right. In other words, a right that is particular to the plaintiff, particular to Tazzy. This analysis—
Counsel, let me interrupt you. But what evidence did you present, other than the fact that Ramirez is your competitor, that you suffered special damages? I mean, the case law seems to be pretty clear that it has to be some special harm. And other than you all, you know, them maybe getting a business edge over your client, what other damages did you all, provide, suffer?
Remember, the law is, this is qualitative, not quantitative. So there needs to be some violation of a legal right. Mm-hmm. And Judge, we had so much evidence presented in this case that right across the street from us, Mr. Ramirez, and this is his own expert's testimony, Mr. Ramirez was not following the standard of care. He had over 100 violations of Chapter 16. He had standing pollutants, including toxins and carcinogens, that were on his property. Eyewitness accounts, odors that exuded from his property, a fire. His own expert said that because Mr. Ramirez is not following the standard of care, he is a fire risk. He says that Mr. Ramirez did not, because of these things, there were toxins and carcinogens on his property. There were other expert testimony that explains that when there's a fire or when there's water that passes on this property, then those toxins, and we're not talking little toxins here, we're talking some of the most poisonous and most carcinogenic materials on our planet. These exude, they become part of the plume of the smoke when there's a fire. And that is a substantial risk of harm. And under DFPS versus Grassroots, City of Temple versus Mitchell, Burdett versus Stevenson, even Maranatha Temple Enterprise versus Enterprises, this kind of reasonable apprehension of fear is sufficient to create standing. Moreover, there was also reputational injury. While it was small, remember the law is a direct stake, quote, no matter how small. There was one instance when, because all this pollution was poured out of Mr. Ramirez's operations right onto the street that abuts my client. Not only does that create a health risk for his property, but it also caused people to blame him. Initially, Tazzy was blamed for that pollution. Now, luckily, that was remedied fairly quickly, but that is reputational harm, albeit slight. Moreover, there's a case, Tushy is the case, that talks about when you have an interest in the reputation of your industry, then when someone engages in behavior that challenges that reputation, that can hurt that reputation, you have a vested legal right in protecting it. And here we have strong evidence and undisputed evidence that the city of San Antonio viewed these businesses as they were called disadvantaged, or not disadvantaged, but disapproved, and I'm not using the right word. They did not like these businesses. And so one of the things that Tazzy did with other members of the industry, but interestingly not Mr. Ramirez, is they worked with the city to be able to take the standard of care and adopt it into Chapter 16. So the city would be less concerned about the auto salvage industry. So protecting the industry's reputation with the city was crucial because there could be some very disastrous effects on the businesses if that reputation of the industry of which TASI has a vested interest was not protected. Moreover, there was some evidence in the record, and I think I talked about it in the brief, regarding some both risk of economic harm and actual economic harm that was suffered by TASI because of Mr. Ramirez's behavior. And I'm going to try to reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Yanta. Mr. Houston.
May it please the court, my name is Sam Houston. I'm here on behalf of the Appalese. I just want to kind of circle back to Ms. Yanta's argument. I view it a little bit differently. And part of the issue that we believe that the JNOV was properly granted was that this claim, there's common law nuisance claims, that you've got public nuisances and you have private nuisances. Well, really the only claim upon which TASI was on this claim, which we called a statutory public nuisance claim. But as the chief had pointed out, we don't believe that Chapter 16 provides a private cause of action. There's specifically nothing in the language that would allow a private citizen to enforce those provisions. We've cited cases and other statutes in our briefing. There are instances where the legislature has created private causes of action where a private citizen can bring forth a nuisance claim. I think there's some gang activity. It's in the Civil Practices and Remedies Code. There's also provisions in the Texas Health and Safety Code, but there's just simply nothing in Chapter 16 that's actually authorizing a private citizen to basically, as Ms. Yanta pointed out, I believe in the case, it's the Cowboy Church case, this do-it-yourself zoning enforcement.
But the Schmidt case did allow a nuisance claim to proceed.
But they're not, but they talk about not having standing, and they cite the case, the GTE MobileNet case, which is out of Houston. And that one's very instructive because it's similar because the homeowners were upset because of this cell phone tower, and they essentially were wanting to enforce the Bunker Hill regulations, zoning regulations, to force them to move this other stuff. And basically, and the court says a private citizen can't get injunctive relief essentially to enforce a municipality's ordinances. That's within the sole domain of the municipality. So that's really, I mean, it becomes a standing issue because, you know, essentially, if you were to read the proposed judgment that they had put together, it really, what they want to do is put themselves, the plaintiffs wanted to put themselves in the shoes of the city because they were upset with the city, you know, not doing its job. And so that's, you know, that's sort of the rub. And if they wanted to do it, and in fact, they did sue the city, but they ultimately not sued those claims. And so we just feel that, you know, the mountain of evidence or the mountain of cases just simply says that this claim does not exist. And I think it's important to draw some distinctions. You know, Ms. Yanta referred to the Bowers case and the Ort case and these other cases. But I think but if you actually go read those cases, they're important distinctions. For instance, those suits are granting or denying requests for a temporary injunction. But as here, it's a request for a permanent mandatory injunction. And in many of those other cases, they're actually suits by private citizens against the government or governmental officials challenging the governmental action. And that's the Bowers case. And so here, it's not a suit against the city, because if they were really upset about the ordinances, but it's something different. It's enforcing the ordinances against another private citizen. And the other distinction is that, you know, like the Ort case, I think it's important. That case really doesn't create this dereliction of duty that this in this goofy question that was submitted to the jury. The root issue in Ort is whether or not a person who can prove a special injury can proceed on a common law public nuisance case, whether or not they're confined to monetary damages or whether or not they can get injunctive relief. It doesn't create any sort of new cause of action based upon the alleged dereliction of duties by a municipality.
So I have a question, though, going back to the Schmitz case, where the court said that Schmitz did have standing to seek redress for the damages caused by a private nuisance. What are the damages that would be permitted in this type of case then, if not what appellants are seeking?
Well, I think you have to draw a distinction because they're talking about a private nuisance. And in this case, the jury rejected the private nuisance claim and found that there was no private nuisance. And so here it's a public nuisance. And so here, essentially what they've proceeded is on a public nuisance claim, that's what we're couching that as a statutory public nuisance claim. And the trial court did not permit the common law public nuisance claim to be submitted because the court found that there was no evidence of substantial special injury, because that's an element of the claim that you can only proceed on a public nuisance claim unless you can show that you suffered an injury separate and different from the public at large. And that's kind of getting back to the discussion that we were having earlier. And we just feel that there is no actual evidence of any sort of special injury. So, you know, they lumped their damages into sort of this monetary damages, but their expert was struck because he basically offered wholly speculative testimony that said, well, because Ramirez was allowed to operate, then that necessarily meant that all of the money that Ramirez generated would have naturally flown to Tassi. Well, that's blatant speculation. And then the other stuff about the mountain of evidence and all of the other polluting activities, there's no evidence to show that that actually affected them. I mean, they could have put on testimony from one of their witnesses to say, yes, it actually damaged us, or it would cause a diminution value of our property or these other things. They didn't. I mean, they just simply offer wholly speculative testimony that, well, we must have been harmed by that. And that's just simply not enough. And it certainly was not deemed to be enough by the trial court.
But counsel, the fact that they're right next door to each other, very close proximity, and it is, I think it was undisputed that, that Mr. Ramirez was creating pollution. Isn't that enough to establish a special injury?
No, because it doesn't establish a special injury separate and apart from the public at large. And so if the argument is that it's just polluting generally, well, then that means that the public at large is suffering. And that doesn't mean that they're suffering any sort of special injury, because it has to be a unique injury to the plaintiff as opposed to the public at large.
Well, I understand that, but the fact that they're the ones, I guess the neighboring one, wouldn't that be sufficient and separate them in that their injury, I guess, would be greater than that of the general public?
I don't believe there's actually any testimony in the record that actually bridges that link, other than to say it's the public at large. But I don't believe that there's any testimony that they actually showed any specific effect to their actual property.
Okay. How about the fact that they're competitors to Ramirez, and the fact that, doesn't Tassi necessarily suffer a special harm or injury because Ramirez does not have to expend any funds to comply with the city ordinance while they do? They are expending funds to comply. Doesn't that create a special injury?
Well, it would if they
sort of unfair competition.
Arguably, I don't know that this unfair competition, and the trial court was skeptical of this notion of unfair competition as that being a cognizable way to calculate your damages. And I frankly couldn't find any authority that actually showed that was sort of this whole idea that I was getting some sort of competitive advantage was somehow recognized way to do damages. But at the end of the day, though, they didn't prove in it, because their whole theory was, well, just because he was allowed to operate, we necessarily must have suffered some sort of injury, and we weren't, but they didn't put on any evidence of, well, Ramirez's profits were this, or this is, you know, I mean, basically there's just no evidence other than blanket speculation as to what the injury was.
So there wasn't any evidence regarding like that Ramirez, as a result of this, could charge lesser prices, or, you know, could somehow create an unfair advantage to the detriment of Tassi, for example, you know, to crush a car or whatever, they could charge less, you know, to do that because they had this windfall and another, you know, by not having to comply with the statute.
All you have in the record is just speculation. I mean, it's just essentially argument by counsel, because there's no evidence to establish what Ramirez was charging. There's actually no hard evidence of what was actually being charged, what was actually being paid. And again, all you have is just this speculative notion, well, he must have had some sort of competitive advantage, because we don't have those numbers, because basically there was one expert offered to talk about Mr. Fairchild that was struck, and to talk about, well, because he just looked at gross profits and said, well, all those gross profits would have necessarily flowed. And in fact, you actually have testimony from, I think, Daniel Hack, who was one of the plaintiffs, just saying that they had revenues of $20 to $30 million a year. So there's just, I mean, there's not really any hard evidence. And so that's our position, is that it would just be wholly speculative. So I did want to point out
sorry.
No, it's okay. Yeah, I got a little off my game here for just a second. So basically, I mean, I just sort of, I'll wrap up here. I think the case is very, very simple, and the judgment should be affirmed. You can look at that statutory public nuisance claim, the one about the dereliction of duties. And I think you can really say that, well, I think the trial court was correct in disregarding it. There's at least four different reasons for it. I mean, I don't think the cause of action actually exists. There's not a private cause of action sort of recognized generally, as we've talked about the GTE Mobile case and other cases. There's no support in the actual language of Chapter 16 that creates a private cause of action. And at the end of the day, you know, Ms. Yanta pointed out this notion of standing, and in her supplemental authorities cited the Heckman case. It's from the Texas Supreme Court. And I just, you know, one of the components of standing is traceability. And at the end of the day, after reading this entire record, you have to prove that there's a connection in this part of the standing analysis between the defendant and the plaintiff's injuries. If you read through all of the record, it's very clear that Tassi is really just upset at the city of San Antonio. And so Heckman says you've got to look at the traceability issue, because you've got to make sure you're actually getting to the right party, and this you're assigning the right defendant. And so, I mean, and it's so clear if you read in our briefing, I talk a lot about sort of the proceedings that was coming up, you know, when the city was added to the case, and then it was removed to federal court, and then the federal court sua sponte kicked it back. I mean, even there, even the federal court was saying this is really a private dispute about two people. And that's really, they're just upset at the city of San Antonio, because that's what they did. That was their whole case. I mean, person after person saying that the city wasn't doing its job. Well, at the end of the day, that's a traceability issue, and that's part of the standing analysis. And so we'd ask that the court affirm the judgment for all the reasons stated in our brief. And if there's no more questions, I'll give my time back.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Houston. Ms. Yantith, you may proceed.
Okay, thank you very much. What you heard was an argument that deals with quantitative analysis of harm rather than qualitative analysis of harm. That's not the proper standard for standing. As the Texas Supreme Court, the Fifth Circuit, the United States Supreme Court has verified that the proper analysis is quantitative. Has there been some violation of a right that is personal to TASI? TASI has the right to have to use its property safely and peacefully. This jury finding, this jury question required the jury to, or the instruction included having the jury find that Ramirez had deprived his neighbors of safe and peaceful use of their property. So we already have, by the way, a jury question that Ramirez did not object to. So that question went to the jury with that particular instruction in order for, they answered yes. When they answered yes, they impliedly found that Mr. Ramirez deprived his neighbors, which is TASI, of the safe and peaceful use of their property. Does that comport with the proper standing for the proper law on standing? Yes, because Texas law is, if there's a substantial risk of harm, you have standing. That's exactly what the jury finding was. In Maranatha, a case that Mr. Houston cites, they say that if there is a reasonable apprehension of fear when a lawful business acts in an unlawful way, there is standing. So the law of Texas is clear that it's not about how much damages, but just that there are some harm. And I will tell you that, first of all, TASI is not just focused on the city of San Antonio. This lawsuit, I think, began with us suing only Ramirez. Later, I think the city became part of the lawsuit. So that's very important. Secondly, I think when you read through this record, you're gonna see that TASI really didn't care about money. What they want is to be safe. What they want is to make sure that Mr. Ramirez competes with the rest of the industry and specifically to them on the same footing. And we aren't required to show any specific dollar amounts. Look at the Walmart case. In the Walmart case, Walmart was not required to provide any kind of economic, hard economic data. Rather, all they had to show was that the nuisance could and probably did cause them to lose business. We have that in spades here. We have that. We didn't have to quantify it. Why? Because even Mr. Ramirez said, I compete with TASI. In fact, he was sued us trying to say that we weren't competing in a fair way. If he could, and then the jury said no. So
what about the, Ms. Yanta, what about the argument that the injunction that you sought put you in the shoes of the city to be the one enforcing its ordinances?
Yeah, this is a really good question. The first thing I'm gonna say is we never got to the injunction. The trial court didn't even look at what the terms of the injunction would be. He just said, as a matter of law, you take nothing. So I can see that argument, Judge. If we went back, as we are gonna ask you to do, to reverse this case and send it back to the trial court for entry of an injunction, if that injunction causes us to just solely step into the shoes of the city and we ask for a criminal fine or we ask for things that only the city can seek, yes, I think you're right. We would have some issues here. But number one, we're not going to do that. We're asking for compliance with the standard of care. And that standard of care is really important in this industry because it prevents exactly what Mr. Ramirez has done. And that is absolutely the evidence in this case. Even his own expert said that if Mr. Ramirez would spend the massive amount of money he needs to comply, he would not pollute like he has been. So Your Honor, there's also a case out there, the Gutter Slough case. I think it shows that an injunction can be provided or can be entered against an auto salvage business that is refusing to do the right thing.
Name of that case again, Gutter what?
It's called Gutter Slough, and I'm probably mispronouncing it.
I'm probably misspelling it too.
There's no doubt that I am misspelling it. It is
in your site.
Yes.
Is it in your brief?
It is in my brief.
Okay, that's fine. If it's in your brief, that's fine. I thought you were adding a case. All right. No,
it's 1996 Westlaw 580931. And so because we absolutely are entitled to an injunction, especially because Chapter 16 incorporates the standard of care, and that is not disputed. Even their own expert agreed to that. And we have a jury finding that Mr. Ramirez's behavior deprived the neighbors of their safe and peaceful use. And there's more than some evidence to support that jury finding. We would ask the court to reverse the JNOV, reverse this judgment, and remand this case for an injunction. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Yanta. Good to see you both. Thank you for your arguments, and the case will be under submission. Have a good day.
Thank you.